We're doing Parshat V'Shalach. We saw in last week's parsha that when the plague of the firstborn hit, so Pharaoh says, get out, get out, get out. And although it would seem the most direct path to enter Israel is to travel northward, Hashem does not take us northward. Hashem takes us in a roundabout way out to the desert. And we're traveling to the land of Israel. And how are we supposed to know how to go? So Hashem sends us a pillar of cloud to guide us. And what about at night? We have a pillar of fire. And then Hashem takes us back to the one idol that was not destroyed during the plague of the firstborn, what's called Piachirot. And Pharaoh assumes that we've gone straight and then we've gone back, so must be we're confused. And so Pharaoh gives chase with his army, and when the Jews turn back and see him behind them, they say, Moshe, didn't we tell you we'd be better off in Egypt than leaving? Well, what are we going to do? We're going to die now? So Moshe says, don't worry, you're going to see Hashem's redemption now. So Hashem sends the angel behind our camp, and the pillar of cloud is now behind us, so the Egyptians can't approach. And all night long, we have this period of tense calm where the Egyptians are behind us and the pillar of cloud, and then we're there. And then Moshe extends his hand over the sea, the Yam Suf, and it splits. And we go into the Yam Suf. We have pillars to our right and to our left. And we go in a semicircle, meaning we go in and we come out the same side we went in on. So the Egyptians come charging after us. And suddenly Hashem makes it shine fire. A pillar of fire breaks the mist, and they're stunned, and then the waters come crashing down. Hashem tells Moshe, extend your hand over the waters now that you're out. And the waters come crashing down on the Egyptians. And after the army is finished, none are left, so the Jews aren't certain if the Egyptians are gone or not, so their bodies are swept onto the shore, and the Jews can loot the bodies with all the wealth they came to battle. So then we have the great song the Jews sing in honor of Hashem, where they recognize that their strength is Hashem, and that Hashem is personally interested in their well-being, how Hashem took down the Egyptians and saved Am Yisrael, even though nations thought they could take down the Jews. Hashem proved that He was beside them, that He is beside them. And we anticipate forward, we look forward to the coming to the land of Israel and establishing a temple where Hashem will be a constant present in our midst. The women also sing, and then the Jews go focusing on the loot. And Moshe has to tell them, guys, we got to go, guys, we got to go. He has to separate them, and we start traveling. So we're 3 days into the desert, and there's no water. And then we come to a place called Marah, and it was given that name because all the water there are bitter. So the Jews can't, as thirsty as they are, they can't drink the waters. And then Hashem shows them how to sweeten the waters. And Hashem tells them, look, until now, all you've seen is how I punish. Here you see I can cure, I can make things better. I am your healer. They come to Elim, and then they continue traveling, and they run out of water. So they start complaining. They say, you know, we would have been better off being back in Egypt, where we had our meat and we had our bread. What'd you take us out here to die in hunger? So Hashem makes it bread come down. This is just an overview. We'll review it with more depth. And they get the man. And Hashem tells them, look, on every day you'll have your portion, but on Friday you get a double portion so that you have food for Shabbos. It won't come down on Shabbos. So any other day that they'd leave over, it would rot. But when they left over from Friday to Shabbos, it stayed fresh. So on Shabbos, someone goes out, these two people, Dustin and Viram, figure, let's go see if it really lands on Shabbos too. And Hashem's upset at them because Hashem told them it wouldn't. They take a portion of man, they put it as a commemoration for the Jewish people for future generations. It would be in the temple. And the nation starts arguing with Moshe, we're thirsty, and Moshe turns to Hashem, and Hashem tells him to hit the rock, and water comes out of the rock. And then Amalek attacks, and Moshe sends Yoshua out to fight Amalek, and when Moshe's hands are up, so we're victorious at war, they place stones under his hands to support him, and then towards the evening, Yoshua has succeeded in weakening Amalek. And Hashem says, write this, you should remember that ultimately I will wipe out Amalek. And Moshe sets up an altar, and he makes a declaration, when we establish a king on the throne, so then we continue the fight. We're not over. Future generations are still going to lead this fight against Amalek. So that's our parsha. Okay, now let's review it with more depth. Okay, you guys ready? Yes.
You said that the Jews were complaining about having water, not having water and meat, but if they were slaves, how did they have meat?
Good question. So let's see that when we review it. Okay, so Hashem takes us in a roundabout way. What would happen if we'd go the straight northern path? So then we'd encounter the Philistines. And what's wrong with encountering the Philistines? There were piles of bones there. Could I ask that people put their phones on silent? So you could turn them off. Turn back on after class. But if you're going to leave them on, at least it should be on silent. Number one, there are bones there from all the tribe of Ephraim that left 30 years too early, and they were all killed, and they purposely left their bones there to scare anyone who would try to escape. Number two, if we'd have to fight the Philistines, so there was still the pact that Avraham Avinu said for three generations, we wouldn't attack one another. So there were still descendants of Avimelech where the pact held, so we weren't allowed to fight them yet. Number three, Hashem says, when the people of Israel sin enough, that's when I'll kick them out and give you the land of Israel. And they hadn't yet deserved to be kicked out. So even though Hashem took us out of Egypt and we were headed to Eretz Yisrael, they did not yet deserve to be kicked out. Number four, when they heard that we were coming to the land of Israel, they destroyed all the trees and they destroyed their homes. They destroyed the streams. They took a long time destroying the country. And when they saw during the 40 years that we were traveling the desert that we weren't coming into the land of Israel, they figured Abraham's other children became nomadic tribes. The other Arabic children of Avraham Avinu, Midian, Ephah, Epher, so they all became nomadic tribes. They figured maybe now we're going to be like them. We're traveling the desert these 40 years. And so they rebuilt Israel. And then when we finally did enter the land of Israel, we caught them by surprise. And we came into a land that was filled with houses, filled with food. Everything was working. It made it easier on us. And number five, we grew from the time we would spend in the desert. We ate the man. Waking up every morning knowing that Hashem is going to give you food from heaven changes a person. So we developed in the time in the desert. We learned how to fight battles. Throughout the time in Egypt, what we knew how to do was build cities. We didn't know how to fight battles. And finally, the splitting of the sea is going to be a tremendous spiritual experience for the Jewish people. Something that never happened before. It's a miracle that a whole people can witness prophecy, as our sages tell us happened at the sea. That even the regular maid saw clarity in the runnings of Hashem, how Hashem runs the world, that prophets never attained. So that's what we call Maaseh Merkava, the understanding of how Hashem runs the world. So that's a clarity which we attain through the miracle of the splitting of the sea. So there was a huge benefit to this whole path. So everyone's busy getting ready to leave Egypt. We make a quick getaway. Even though Moshe says we're only leaving midday and Pharaoh and the Egyptians are rushing us, when we leave, the dough doesn't have time to rise, which means we were able to make it out of our house and gather and leave Egypt in 18 minutes. That's a huge feat for any battalion, to have 18 minutes to get the other 2 million people. So the Jews are able to run very quickly. They get their act together. When the time comes, b'chipazon, that's why we're rushed to make the matzah, to commemorate how quickly we left Egypt. When the time came, it happened like a flash. 18 minutes is tremendous timing for families to get their act together. If you ever try to make a trip, you know that till you go to the bathroom, till you go to the bathroom again, till you forget your drink, you forget your cup, you forget, you know, getting a family to move takes a long time. 18 minutes and everyone's assembled and moving. Yes?
But they left in the morning. They could have done it at night.
But Hashem said, I don't want you to leave like fugitives. I want you to leave midday. That's true. That's true. So everyone's gathering their belongings. And Moshe says, we have a promise to keep. We had promised Yosef we would take his bones out with us. So Moshe goes searching for Yosef's bones. No one knows where the bones are. So he goes to the old woman, Serach, the daughter of Asher, the adopted daughter of Asher, who's still alive. Remember, why is she still alive? Why did she marry to live such a long life? Because...
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Ah, she knows. Ah, honey, Yosef, hold on, you know. Correct, she sang a song in the heart.
Oh, so when it came time to give Yaakov the news that Yosef was alive, she was preparing him by singing songs about how Yosef's still alive. And so that when Yaakov heard the news, it didn't catch him that much by surprise, even though he fainted, even though it did catch him by surprise, but she prepared him. So he blessed her. She would have longevity. And so she lived. She lived and lived and lived and lived. She lived till the days of David HaMelech. We're going to learn about her next week. Ah, no, not here. Sorry, it's a different class. We're going to learn about her down the road. Moshe goes to her and asks her, where is Yosef? So we have two different traditions as to where Yosef was buried. One tradition says they buried him in the pyramids. They buried him with all the other Egyptian kings. And so Moshe went out to the pyramids and started looking, and then he came upon a series of coffins, and he didn't know which one was Yosef's. So he said, Yosef, reveal yourself. The Jews are leaving Egypt. We want to keep our promise. If you don't reveal yourself, there's nothing we can do. And Yosef's casket started shaking. So Moshe knew which casket was his. So that's one approach in the Gemara. Another understanding the Gemara tells us is that the Egyptians put him in a lead casket in the Nile, either because they assumed we would not leave Egypt without him, so they figured this would lock us in, or because they wanted the Nile to be blessed, and they thought he brought such prosperity to Egypt, so if his casket is in the Nile, that will bless the Nile. So Moshe goes to the Nile, and he says, Yosef, reveal yourself. And nothing doing. And he says, Yosef, the time has come. Hashem's taking the Jews out of Egypt. You have to reveal yourself. And he takes a piece of gold, and he writes on it Hashem's hidden name. And then he writes, Alei Shor, arise, ox. And he tosses it into the Nile. And the casket made of lead floats to the top. And Moshe grabs it and takes it out. Now, there was this little kid who was always tagging along. He was a baby when the Egyptians were putting children in the mortar. And Moshe saw these babies being killed by the Egyptians. He said, Ribbono Shalom, how could you do this? And Hashem said, believe me, I'm just taking thorns out of the vineyard of Israel. These are people who are better off. It's better for them and better for the world that they not be around. And if you want to see, take one out. So Moshe goes to the mortar and he pulls out a baby and he cleans him off. And this baby grows up and he's tagging along behind Moshe. So when Moshe throws that sliver into the water and the casket comes up, Moshe walks away and the kid grabs that sliver. Now, he's already a young adult. And when the Jews will all be dancing around the gold that they put into the fire, when Moshe's going to ascend to heaven for 40 days and 40 nights, and he won't come down, and then they'll make a party, and they'll say, we have to have a new leader. Moshe's never coming back. So they're going to put gold and silver and make a big fire. And this kid, this young man, is going to take this piece of gold. It says, arise, ox. It was written with Moshe, with special spiritual intentions, and it has Hashem's hidden name written on the back of it, and throw it into the fire. And what comes out of the fire? A young ox. Hashem's hidden name, and the saying, Alei Shor, come out, ox. So Moshe takes Yosef's body, he takes Yosef's coffin, And he takes it with him because we promised we would. So Hashem takes us out. It says, "V'chamushim aluvnei Yisrael." The Jewish people left Egypt either chamushim means armed. They left Egypt with arms. Or it means one-fifth. That's what we discussed, that so many people died. So, we're leaving Egypt. And Pharaoh sends along spies. And when they see after 3 days that we're not coming back, they come back to tell Pharaoh. Now, what's extraordinary is that we have this pillar of cloud leading us and a pillar of fire to give us light. So can you imagine how big this pillar of fire was? If it's giving light to 2 million people?
It's cloudy outside.
Think about it. That's a huge pillar. How do you attack a people when you see they have this miracle going before them, a pillar of fire? And how do you write such a thing in the Torah? To my mind, one of the greater proofs as to the validity of the Torah is that the Torah writes that for 40 years we had a pillar of fire. That's something which is difficult to make up, because people will say, how come my father didn't tell me, my grandfather didn't tell me? The Torah writes that for 40 years, wherever we traveled, and the Torah records where we traveled, man would come down 6 days a week, and not on the seventh. So if you go to the Sinai Desert, we used to have a Marine in our class, and he served in Sinai, and he told us that there are places in Sinai where something edible comes down from the sky in the Sinai Desert. So that's very nice, but does it come down 6 days a week or seven? 7 days a week. And does double come down on Friday as opposed to the other days? There's a discussion among the commentaries. Some want to say that that's what came down for Israel. Whatever it is, it was called man. And if you ever make it out there to the Sinai Desert, make sure it's safe. So there are places where something forms on the dew that's edible. He didn't know to describe it exactly. You guys can look into it. I don't know what it is. So some say that this is what the Jews got. It's something natural that forms. What was unnatural was that it would go wherever they would camp. And a double portion would come down on Friday as opposed to Shabbos. Others say no. They thought it was this thing that forms naturally on the ground of the desert. And that thing is called man. They mistakenly thought manu. That's that man that forms naturally in the Sinai Desert. And the name stuck. But really it wasn't the same thing. So they get a double portion on Friday, right? We commemorate that. We have double challah. Friday night, we have two challahs. We make a motzi. We have something under the challah. We have something over the challah. We commemorate what the Torah writes, that there was dew under the man and over the man. So these miracles, the pillar of light and the man going with them for 40 years, to my mind, is a much more powerful proof than other proofs. Because this is something we've been saying. My father tells me at the Seder night that his father told him, that his father told him. All about the stories of how we left Egypt. So we continue. The Egyptians hear that we're not coming back. And they lent us all this wealth. So they're getting very upset. And they say, who's going to be our servants now? So Pharaoh tells his men, I'm giving you gifts. Ordinarily, when we win a war, I get the loot and then I give whatever I want. We're going to share it equally now. We're all going together. And they charge. He takes there were some pious Egyptians who were careful. When Hashem said, watch your animals, so they took their animals in. And then what happens when it comes time to give chase of the Jews? They all volunteer their animals. You could use my animal, go give chase of the Jews. So sages warned us that even when someone seems pious, you have to be careful. You have to wonder what their value system is, because they might seem pious one day, and then you don't know where how their behavior will be another day.
You say very often, right? I one of these Arabic texts, he was a nice janitor. This is the Hebron that they met in 1920.
Yeah, my grandfather told me that he can list names of towns where their neighbors turned on them in one day and demolished the whole town. He said there are mass graves all across Europe. It was well known during the time of the Holocaust that this happened. It wasn't one town. They found one or two. They made a big deal out of it. He said he remembers it was well known. This thing happened more than once. It happened numerous times. So our sages said this story of the Egyptians volunteering their horses tells us something. Chazal used very harsh terminology, but the basic idea is when a person did something nice, you have to know what their value system is, not just what their one action is. These Egyptians were also good Egyptians. When Hashem warns them, they put away their cattle. So Paro's heart is hardened again, and he's running after the Jews, and the Jews set up a flag, and the Egyptians are rushing after them, and Hashem sends the Egyptian angel above the Egyptians, and the Jews turn around, and they see the Egyptians coming with their swords drawn, and the Egyptian angel is hovering above the Egyptian people as they're giving chase. The Jews come back and they see one idol. There were two mountains, one in the form of a man, one in the form of a woman. Remember, Egyptians are very big into promiscuity. So these were the two mountains that were left. Every other idol was demolished at midnight at the plague of the firstborn. The Jews come back and they're standing opposite these two mountains that are Egyptian gods. And the Egyptians say, those are the gods that are entrusted to ensure that no slave escapes Egypt. You see, even the Jewish God couldn't overcome our God of Pi'achirot. Look at that. He demolished every other god, but he didn't demolish that god. So obviously that god is the most powerful one, right by Baal Tzephon. So Pharaoh approaches. And now the Jews feel like they're in a bind. Throughout the 10 plagues, the Jews were comfortable. Hashem was taking care of everything. Now suddenly they're in the bind. They have to act. Pharaoh's chasing them. So they're very scared. It's understandable. The boss is coming. The boss who they were so scared of, who killed their children. Now he's chasing after them with his army. So they call out to Hashem. So the pious ones call out to Hashem. The people who were not pious came to Moshe with sarcasm. What do they say? Moshe, was there a shortage of graves in Egypt? That's why we had to come out here? Believe me, we could have died there. Reverse says that's why Jews have a good sense of humor. They know how to deal with the dangers of life. You see, they have sarcasm even in the face of death. They can be humorous. So Moshe says, don't worry. Hashem's going to save you. Watch. So the Jews look, and what do they see? They see on one side is a desert. They got nowhere to go. Another side is the sea. And another side is the enemy. And another side is the Egyptians. Where are they going to go? So our sages say this moment is compared to the dove. The dove was flying peacefully when the vulture caught sight of the dove. And the vulture gave chase, and the dove flew. And the vulture is getting closer and closer, and the dove is flying for all it's worth, and the dove sees a small crevice in the mountain, and it swoops down for the crevice, and the vulture swoops after it, and the vulture lunges, and the dove lunges into the hole. And so the vulture hovers over the hole looking, and it cannot fit in the hole to chase after the dove. The dove looks out at the vulture peers in at the dove is breathing heavily, and suddenly it hears movement inside the hole. It turns around and it sees a snake approaching. So it looks back at the snake as the snake is approaching menacingly at the dove. It looks out at the vulture that's still hovering before the opening. And at that point, what does the dove do? It raises its eyes to heaven. And that's what our sages say. That's the verse in the Song of Songs. Hashmi'ini et kolech, Harini et Mar'eich. Hashem says, I want to hear your voice. Yonati bechagvei asela, my dove, you're in the cracks of the rock. And now you got nowhere to go, right? That I want to hear you. What is this similar to? There was a king. He was traveling, and suddenly he hears a maiden in distress. Save me, save me. So he runs out to save her. And after he fights the villains, so he brings her home peacefully. Thank you, mister, thank you. And then he sends messengers. Maybe she'll want to marry him. And she doesn't want to answer his messengers. So what does he do? He hires villains.
and he plans with them. This is where she lives. He finds out when she leaves her home. And then one day the villains attack again and again, save me, save me. And in comes the king charging with his men and he fights off the villains. Now she's willing to talk to him. That's the way our lives go. On a daily basis, we're supposed to talk to the Ribbono Shel Olam. We're supposed to have conversation. But we walk into shul, we walk out of shul, we've paid the lip service, but what connection is there? Does man really connect? So Hashem sends us problems in our lives. Am Yisrael is on the brink of destruction. The Egyptians are behind them. The sea is in front of them. They have nothing to hope for. They turn to Hashem.
Why don't we connect?
So the Magid Midivna in the beginning of the book discusses how we have a tendency to connect to what we see and sense. And to connect to Hashem is something that we don't see and sense. When we have a problem, then we come back to our values and we say, actually, Ribbono Shel Olam, you're in charge, help me out here. But when things go smoothly, we feel like, Ribbono Shel Olam, you're doing your thing, I'm doing my thing. Well, you know, so I come to shul 3 times a day, but my heart's pumping okay. That's nice. I can see. That's nice. I walked off the sidewalk and I wasn't paying attention if a car was coming, but I walked back onto the sidewalk okay. That's nice. What do you have to do with all this? You know the guy who was looking for a parking spot, right?
Yeah.
So that's how we lead our lives. For those of you who don't know, he says, Ribbono Shel Olam, I've been looking for 15 minutes. If you show me a parking spot, I'm going to stop my life and learn the parsha. I'm going to give a 100 shekel to charity. Ribbono Shel Olam, help me out. And as he's saying that, a car pulls out in front of him. And he says, never mind, Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm okay. Right? So that's... I found one, yeah. So that's how we lead our lives. Never mind, Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm managing. Right. Wait, I just want to give a practical example. Okay, I have a friend who's a general in the army, and he told me that there are months where every day there are over 7 attempted suicide bombings. Months, he said. They don't let the media know because the nation would panic. They'd go out of their minds if they would know how many attempted suicide bombings there are on an average day. He said that he can tell me what he's seen in a month. And we live here and we're comfortable and everything's great. Never mind, Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm doing okay. What do you mean you're doing okay? How are you doing okay? By what logic? By what might? By what right? So we ignore it until suddenly we're reminded. Yes. Okay, so that's for a Thursday night. Let's continue. Yes.
So then if you connect to the, if you sincerely talk to God and you're trying to, a lot of times seems like you can, well, what's the point? Because God's going to do whatever he wants anyway. Like, you, I don't know if I suppose this, example that you pray for peace and then there's a giant kibbutz the next day. So why? If God's gonna do what he wants, I can try to do what, you know, try to connect, but what, why? And if God's gonna do what he wants anyway, so then,
because through tefillah you can change your fate.
If a doctor tells you that by eating healthy, by lowering your cholesterol, so then you stand a greater chance of living past the age of 65. If you stop smoking, you stand a greater chance of living past the age of 55. So you'll say, but people die in car accidents, and people have heart attacks anyways, and people have strokes, and there's so many diseases. Right, but within the system, this is beneficial. And very often it's going to make a difference. Can you say, is there an exact science that if you lower your cholesterol, I can guarantee you, you'll live another 10 years? No, there are many factors involved. The same is true with prayer. There are many factors involved, but this is a major factor. I wouldn't have said it. Ordinarily, logic would dictate. Hashem runs the world, and I'm not even a pea in the grand scheme of things. You know, a kernel of sand. What am I? Think of how many billions of people are living now. How many billions of people have lived over the course of the millennium? So what am I? I'm a drop in the bucket in all of world history. And yet Hashem tells me, you daven and it matters. If he wouldn't tell me so, I wouldn't have thought so. If Hashem wouldn't have told us that davening matters, then logic dictates that we don't matter. Along comes the Torah and says every one of you matters and you can make a difference. The Torah focuses on individuals and shows us how individuals changed history. How the daughter of Pharaoh chose to make a move that changed history. The Torah repeatedly points out to us how individuals that made the right decisions not only affected themselves, but affected their people and the world at large. And the same is true for davening. Here, we have a job to do. Moshe starts davening, and Hashem says, move. Now's not the time for prolonged davening. Now you got to act. Okay? Matitzak elai, Hashem says. What are you standing and davening for? It's not the time. The Jews are suffering. Help them out. So Moshe, perhaps, was not so worried. On his level of bitachon, so what? So the Egyptians are right there. What difference does it make? So Hashem tells him, tell the Jews to travel. You lift your staff over the sea, and it will split, and the Jews will have dry land, and they'll go there. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians. They will follow them. That's a phenomenal thing. You see these people have a pillar of fire in front of them. You see they have a pillar of cloud. Now it's worse than that, because we have a tradition that every one of the plagues that the Egyptians suffered in Egypt came back 5 or 10 or 50-fold by the sea. What does that mean? That means that the Egyptians are behind us, and wild animals start attacking them, and their animals start dropping dead, and their water turns to blood. Even their saliva starts turning to blood. How, I'm making this up. I don't know exactly how it happened that it was 5 times as harsh. But every plague repeated itself. So they couldn't say, we forgot. Let's start thinking. Dom, their water's turning to blood. They're standing there behind us. In case they forgot what happened 12 months ago, their water's turning to blood. And grasshoppers are attacking them. And frogs are attacking them. And they're being eaten by lice. And some of their animals are starting to drop dead. So every single plague is repeating itself. The night before the splitting of the sea is when they have that 7th day of Makas Choshech. Remember, they had 6 days of the plague of darkness. Every other plague had 7. Right, they got their dues. They paid their dues on the night before. Suddenly it becomes so dark, a darkness that they never had before. And then Hashem's going to stun them with the great light of the pillar of fire. But what's going on here? Yeah, hatred could lead a person to many places. So they want us, dead or dead, they want us. And they're willing to chase us. And their hearts are hardened. And even when they see the sea has split, after all the miracles they see, they charge. And remember, we said, if they would do tshuva, if they'd say Hashem's the boss, we should really listen to him, that they could do. When Hashem hardened their heart, it's just that they shouldn't think, gee, it doesn't really make sense, I'm losing. There's a logical, even if you don't believe in Hashem, there's a certain logical deduction that says, I'm losing. Our sages say, what's this similar to? A king sends his servant out. You guys know the mushel of the fish. He sends his servant out and he tells him, look, I want you to bring me fish. So the servant brings back a rotten fish. And then the king says, you didn't pay attention what fish you were supposed to buy? So the servant says, I guess not. Okay, so the king says, you have a choice. You can either get 50 lashes or eat the rotten fish or pay 50 gold coins. So the servant says, okay, I'll eat the rotten fish. So he takes the fish and he eats 1 bite, 2 bites, and then he starts throwing up. And his stomach is churning and he takes a 3rd bite. And he's throwing up his guts out, and he takes a 4th bite, and he forces himself to the 5th bite, and he's slowly making his way down the fish, and he's throwing up so badly that he can't anymore. So he's halfway done with the fish, and he says, I can't, I'll take the lashes, I can't anymore. So they take him out, And they start giving him the lashes. And he's yelling his head off. He gets one, he gets two, he gets 15, he gets 25. He's halfway through the lashes and he says, I'm going to die. My heart can't take it. Stop. I'll pay, I'll pay, I'll pay. He goes home and he brings the 50 gold coins. So what did he do? He ate the fish and he got the lashes and he paid the money. Wouldn't he have been better off paying the money initially? That's Paro. Hashem tells him, you know, I'm going to destroy you. Think of what was left in Egypt. Egypt was desolate. You know what it means that a plague of grasshopper comes? Can you imagine 50 million grasshoppers eating everything? That means Egypt became a desert. It's a wasteland. The houses are demolished. You have nothing. What's left to Egypt? The economy is destroyed. They have no food. They're going to have to import everything. They have no men. The men have all died here at the Yam Suf. They have no leaders, their firstborn are dead. They have no cattle. They're finished. Their economy is destroyed. When the Jews left Egypt, they left behind a wasteland. There was nothing. Anything of value they've lent to the Jew. So now, of course, they're chasing the Jew to the sea. But now they see the sea split. Maybe it's not such a good idea. So Hashem makes his appearance be like a female horse. And Pharaoh's horse sees this horse and gets very excited and charges after that horse into the sea. And the other people behind them, they think Pharaoh's charging, they're behind him. They charge after him, so everyone runs into the sea. And when they run into the sea, Hashem makes the earth turn muddy and their chariots get caught in the mud and the earth turns hot and the horseshoes come off and the horses start jumping in the air from the hot mud, and they throw the people off, but the people have tied themselves onto the horses, and the waves come crashing down, and the Egyptians are thrown up and down, and they're finished. So the Egyptians have paid a hefty price, and the Jews come out on the same side they went in on. As we described, there were 12 paths of semicircles, half circles, right, moon shapes, and they come out of the Yam Suf. So the Egyptians are finished, and the Jews come out, and they say, gee, maybe the Egyptians came out the other side just like we did. So the sea spits out the Egyptian bodies, and they see that their masters are dead. So the Jews are going to sing. So their first minute as free men, what do? They sing. It's a very interesting thing. The beginning of the Jewish people is a song. And our name at the end of the Torah is Yeshurun, the nation that knows how to sing. Maybe Thursday night we should take time to learn Az Yashir. We'll just discuss one aspect of Az Yashir. We have two forms of song in the Torah. Sometimes a song is written in two columns, like Ha'azinu. You have two or three words, and then a gap, and then two or three words. And then the next line has, again, two or three words, and then a gap, and two or three words. Okay, so you have two columns of words, and one central column of a gap. That's the way the song of Ha'azinu is written. Then you have songs that are written where you have two or three words, a gap, and two or three words. And then the next line, you'll have a gap, and then two or three words, and then a gap. So you always have words over a gap, and a gap over words. Yeah, you guys understand the concept? If you look at the Sefer Torah at Az Yashir, you'll see that that's how Az Yashir is written. Perhaps the Torah is written that way too. There we go. Can you guys see that form over here in the Song of Az Yashir? There's always words over a gap or gap over words. So that's a tradition we have. There are two ways. Ariach al-gabei levena, levena al-gabei ariach. Notice the focus is we're coming to Israel and we're going to build a temple. Our sages say that there were three levels of how the Egyptians were punished. Those who were most sinful were shaken up and down and up and down until they died. Those who were mediocre had a lesser punishment. And then there were those who died like lead. And that's why in the song we have three descriptions of how the Egyptians sunk, because it depended on what they deserved. Which leads us to another question, which we won't discuss tonight, which is the question of Ashgacha Pratit.
Do non-Jews also have Ashgacha Pratit? Does Hashem actually watch over every non-Jew and decide what their fate is going to be? So Miriam takes a tambourine. So why did she have a tambourine? And all the women are going with a tambourine. That's what you take when you're going to a long journey? Yeah. If you see a positive future, so then what part of what you need to take with you is instruments to make song. Again, we see the Jewish people are people of song. When they're leaving Egypt, one of the things they're taking with them are instruments of song. So the Jews are very attracted to the money, which is interesting because they were very wealthy. So they're traveling 3 days and they have no water. And they come to a place called Mara and the waters are bitter. So our sages say, let's read the Pasuk. V'lo yachelu lishtot mayim mara. They couldn't drink the waters of Mara, ki marim him, for they were bitter. Who was bitter? The water was bitter? Or sages say the people were bitter. Here they were coming out, and they look back at everything that happened, and they have time to reflect, and they say, gee, Hashem is very tough. Look at what Hashem's been doing. A whole year, all we see is how Hashem punishes. He punishes the Egyptians with blood, and frogs, and lice, and wild animals, and pestilence, animals drop dead, and boils, and then hail, and then locusts, and then darkness, and then all the firstborn die. And now look at what he did. All the Egyptians died there. This is the Hashem we have to deal with now. What does Hashem do? All he does is punish. That's all we've seen here. So they were embittered. They suddenly said, what are we doing? So Hashem brought them to a place, and they couldn't drink the waters. So they come complaining to Moshe. They say, what are we going to drink? So Hashem shows them a tree to throw into the waters, and the waters become sweet, and they see how Hashem makes things better, and Hashem promises them, oh, everything you saw in Egypt, I'm not bringing you. Keep my mitzvos, and all the punishments you saw, I'm not going to give you. You don't have to worry. You don't think, oh, Hashem's going to now do to us what he did to the Egyptians. If we do something wrong, all our water will now turn to blood. No, I promise you, keep the Torah, and you will not have any of the punishments that happened in Egypt. Ani Hashem rofeecha, I'm Hashem, your healer. I'm here to help you. My goal isn't to punish, my goal is to help. Ani Hashem Rofecha. So that's a paradigm shift. The Jews kept seeing Hashem as the one who punishes. Now Hashem says that's not the point. So that's one understanding. Our sages say that the Jews were going out into the desert and they didn't have a Torah. So you can't live without a Torah. That's one of the rules you have to know. If you find yourself depressed, if you find yourself lost, if you find yourself lacking meaning in life, if you find yourself with difficulties in your interpersonal relationships, if you find yourself that life is not going the way you want, almost always you should look back and say, where can I have some Torah time? Torah time helps us hit the reset button. It gives me time to reset myself. Intelligent wives will want their husbands to learn Torah, because if they're really learning Torah, then they come home different people. They speak differently, they behave differently, their values are different. Torah makes us different. So the people are traveling out in the desert and they have no Torah. Sham sam lo chokum mishpat v'sham nisau. Our sages say, there they were given statutes, that we were given the mitzvah of Parah Aduma. There they were given monetary laws, and there they were given the mitzvah of Shabbos. We were given three types of mitzvos to deal with. Because if you have a Torah to deal with, then you become a different person. One of the things Moshe says is, we're not going to be a nomadic tribe where you start stealing from one another. We're going to establish a legal system here. We don't yet have the Torah. Okay, so we'll set up our own legal system. So the people were embittered and they were given the tree to sweeten life. What's the tree to sweeten life? Torah. It's Chaimi. It's the tree of life. That was the tree of life in the Garden of Eden, the Torah. So we were given the mitzvah of Shabbos even before we reached Sinai. We come to Elim. We have 12 streams of water and 70 palm trees, which shows us how nature reflects the Jewish people, the 12 tribes, the 70 elders. And we start traveling to the desert of Sin. We're on our way to Sinai. And the people start complaining. And they say, you know, we used to have meat. So Alexis asked, what meat did they have? So one understanding is that there were different people who had different positions in Egypt. There were those people who had meat back in Egypt. Another understanding is that this was the Erev Rav. Who was the complainer?
the people who were Egyptians, who had joined the Jewish people, they were the ones who were leading the complaint. They really had the good life back in Egypt. They said, what did we come out here for? So they were the ones who always led the problems in Israel. So here that's one of the things they're saying. We used to have plenty of meat, plenty of bread. What'd you take us out here to die? So Hashem tells Moshe, bread's going to come out of the heaven. And they should go out and collect it. Or sages say, different people had the bread fall in different places. If you were a righteous person, it fell right by your door. If you were a little less righteous, you had to go out to the front yard. If you were even less righteous, you had to go to the center of town. If you were really bad, you had to go out to the fields to collect it. So every morning you got a grade from heaven. What type of human being are you? You said you're benching not well yesterday. Boy, I wonder where you find your bread. So Moshe institutes for them benching, the first blessing of benching. And Moshe tells them they have to prepare. They're going to get double bread on Friday, and they have to prepare. Any meal we eat on Shabbos should be with double bread. Yeah, what happens if you're in the army, you're on a trip, and you don't have bread, you have cakes. So take two loaves of cakes.
But Shalosh
Sudas, right, so Shalosh Sudas needs two loaves of bread. What happens if you, if you don't have it, you don't have it, but the proper way to do Shalosh Sudas, not only that, the Ramah says, what happens if you're early to rise, okay? So you go and daven early in the morning, you daven Vasikin, you finished your minion, you go and eat the morning meal, okay? It's 6:30 in the morning, you want to have breakfast, so you take two loaves of bread, you make hamotzi, you eat your meal. Okay, then the machon has its meal at 11:30. By 11:30, you're hungry again. So you say, okay, that's my third meal today. Fine, I'll eat my third meal. Then you're hungry by Shalosh Sudas time. So you come to Shalosh Sudas, you say, I had my three meals. My three meals, two breads each meal. I'm good, right? No, even if you have a fourth meal. You go to Sheva Brachos, you're going to have a fifth meal. Every meal you have on Shabbos should have two loaves of bread. The two loaves of bread represent the man that we had a double portion when the man came down on Friday. So that's what we do. We have a double portion, and we cover it on bottom and on top. Some have the custom that they take the cover off when they make the blessing. Why do we cover the challah? One understanding is that technically, if you're having grape juice and challah, you should begin with making the blessing on challah. How come you give the grape juice precedence? Because you want to make Kiddush. Kiddush is the beginning of your recognition of the day of Shabbos. So if you forgot Kiddush, okay? You're a newcomer. You're the first week after you get married. You come home and you and your wife are talking and you're schmoozing. And then you say, okay, let's wash. You make hamotzi. You're in the middle of the meal and suddenly you see the becher there in front of you. You say, honey, did we make Kiddush? She says, you see the Kiddush cup in front of you. Did we make Kiddush? You look at it and it's dry. You say, gee, I don't remember. She says, I don't think you made Kiddush. So you make Kiddush then. Okay, you forgot Kiddush. You make Kiddush then in the middle of the meal. You make Kiddush. Why do we give the wine precedence? Because Kiddush is the beginning of the recognition of the day. So bread should have precedence, so we cover the bread. That way, if the bread were before us, if it weren't covered, really the bread should have precedence. So if you're at a Kiddush, Shabbos morning, technically you should cover the Mazonos cakes, because they also have precedence. People don't do it. Okay, so when you'll make your own Kiddush at home, you should know that you also have to cover Mazonos. You don't only have to cover the bread. If you're in a Kiddush where no one does it, fine. But if you're in your own home, so you should cover not only the bread, but also the Mazonos, the cakes and stuff. Okay, so we also cover it to commemorate the month. That's another reason we cover it. So Moshe says the famous line of V'nachnu Ma. When the Jewish people come complaining to him and Aaron, he says that famous line. What do we have anything to do with this? Why are you complaining to us? You guys want bread. You're hungry. Hashem's going to give you bread. Hashem's going to give you meat. But why are you complaining to us? V'nachnu Ma. What are we? What do we have to do with this? Notice how Moshe does not take credit. Look at all the miracles he's done. For a whole year, every month is a new miracle. What does Moshe say? What do I have to do with any of this? That's Moshe's humility. Okay, so we said the Jews got their meat, the slav, which was a big, fat, bird, fish-like creature, which had a lot of fat. When you'd cook it, it would drip so much fat that you could wipe 13 loaves of bread with that fat, with the fat that would drip as you'd cook the slav. So that's what they get for 40 years. They're going to get this. Every morning they're going to get their mun. And there was a miracle about the mun, that the mun, if you took too much, you'd come home and you'd find you had the right amount. If you didn't take enough, you'd come home and you'd find you had the right amount. So Hashem tells them, this is what you're supposed to get, an omer. An omer is the value of a tenth of an ephah. That's 1.8 se'ah. Okay, so we should do the math on that. That's 1.8 se'ah. So that's somewhere in the range of 4 kilo. Okay, so that's the amount of bread they got every day. They'd have breakfast and supper. Okay, so they had a large loaf for breakfast and a large loaf for supper. It's a lot of food. It doesn't seem like they ate lunch.
Didn't Rabbi Frankel bring snacks?
They had a big meal in the morning and a big meal at night. And if they didn't collect it, as midday came, it would melt. And there would be a stream of mun flowing in the desert. And the animals would come and eat it. And then when the nations would start hunting those animals, they would taste the flavor of the mun in the animals. Because the animals were sipping the mun that melted. And then the nations would start praising Am Yisrael. They'd say, look at how delicious the animals are. Now we also benefit from the Jews getting mun. Yeah?
I heard an opinion say something along the lines that out of the 24 hours, they would get up, they would wait a little bit, they would eat. Then 6 hours later, they would eat again, and then they would stay up a little longer and then go to sleep. And that's where the whole, waiting 6 hours and waiting so on and so forth came about.
Gemara says, Shari Shona Machaludim, Shnia Machalistim. The Gemara says either the fourth or fifth hour of the day is when a person should eat ordinarily. So that's the first meal. Breakfast is supposed to be pretty late in the day if you're a productive person. So you get up in the morning and you daven and you do whatever you have to do, and then you finally eat. And then about 6 hours later, you're going to eat again, right? So that was the time that they would have in between meals. There's a netziv that way. The netziv understands that way, that the pause, the break in between the meals, and the Gemara in Tractate Shabbos tells us that a productive person eats his meal later in the morning. Don't forget, they would get up at the crack of dawn or earlier. So they would eat later in the day, right? They would eat closer to noon. That's true. You asked about lunch. That's a good point. Their breakfast was something like 10:30. That's when they'd eat breakfast.
Brunch.
Right. Their breakfast was a brunch.
How do you say brunch in Hebrew?
I don't know. So they're given their first Shabbos. And they're told you shouldn't bother going out because there won't be any mun for you. So Dasan and Aviram, they take some of their mun and they put it out in the field and they want to come back and tell the Jews, you see, it didn't work. Mun came down, we found it out in the field. So they take some mun, they put it out in the field. They take their portion, their extra portion they were given for Shabbos. They put it out in the field and they come back to the Jews and they say, guess what? Mun came down from heaven all over again today. The Jews say, really? Can't be. Hashem said not. So they say, come, we'll show you. They go back out to the field, and all the mun is gone. Where did it all go? The birds came and ate it. That's why we have a custom that we give bird food before Shabbos, this Shabbos, Shabbos Shira. There you'll see all the kids coming home with bird cages and stuff that they make in Gan, because on this Shabbos, on Friday afternoon, before Shabbos, we give the birds some food. We reward them that they covered up so that there wouldn't be a Chilul Hashem, because if the Jews would come out there, then people would hesitate. They'd think, maybe this isn't Hashem running the show. You see, Hashem said no mun would come down today, and it did come down today. So people wouldn't be so quick to know that Dasan and Aviram were the tricksters behind it. So the birds came, and we reward the birds every year anew. We give them a little bit of bird food. You give them a little bit of breadcrumbs, challah crumbs. You give them on this Shabbos as a thanks that back then they ensured there wouldn't be a Chilul Hashem. Datan and Aviram, the two troublemaker brothers. We always encounter them making trouble.
They were the two who were fighting in Egypt, right? I didn't hear you.
Were they also the two that went to some altar when they were supposed to?
No, no, no.
I didn't see this part at all. Who were the two that jumped into the river?
Which river?
Red Sea. Weren't the two brothers that jumped into the Red Sea before the war?
Othniel ben Kenaz. Othniel ben Kenaz. When Hashem tells the Jewish people, travel, the sea will split. So everyone's talking. Who's going to go first? Every tribe started fighting. They picked up sticks. They picked up rocks. And Othniel ben Kenaz wasn't interested in anything. He went first. He went. And he kept walking into the sea. And until it reached his nostrils. And he said, Ribbono Shel Olam, that's it. Now I can't breathe. Now it's up to you. I did what I could. And then the sea split. We say it in Hallel. Yehuda sanctified Hashem's name. All the tribes were talking about it. But Yehuda sanctified Hashem's name when Othniel ben Kenaz charged the sea. Yes?
Which, by tradition, which sea, which body of water are we talking
about? Yam Suf.
Red Sea. Not the Straits of Turin?
No. Okay. So Moshe is told, go hit the rock so that the Jews have water. And he hits the rock and water comes pouring out. We learned about that earlier today. And being that the Jews questioned, is Hashem in our midst? Can he really give us water or not? So they've weakened themselves, and that's when Amalek comes to attack. When the Jews are weak and they say, hey, is Hashem with us or not? A guy was carrying his son on his shoulders, and every time the kid wanted something, he'd say, Dad, could you get that for me? Dad, could you get me that apple? He'd go and pick the apple and give it to the kid. Dad, can you pick up that toy for me? He'd pick up the toy. Every time the kid needed something, he'd give the kid whatever he wanted. And then they meet up with a fellow, and the kid goes to the fellow, and he says to him, you see my dad anywhere? So the father says, see my dad anywhere? You don't know where I am? I'm the one who's taking care of you, giving you everything you want? He takes him off his shoulders. A dog comes and bites the kid. So then the father picks him up again. Oh, now you know where I am, right? That's the Jewish people. Everywhere they're going, Hashem's giving them what they need. They need bread, they get bread. They need the water sweetened, they get the water sweetened. Everything they need, they get. Then suddenly they're thirsty. They say, hey, where's their Ribbono Shel Olam? Is he here? Can he help us? So Amalek comes and attacks. So Moshe tells Yehoshua, I want you to choose people. People who were born in the leap year, in Adar Beis. People who were born in Adar Beis don't have a mazel in the zodiac. They can go and defeat Amalek, and Amalek, with all their sorcery, can't touch them. So Moshe goes up the hilltop. He takes the staff of Hashem. And the Jews are supposed to look at him, and he will point out to them, look up to Hashem, and that's when you will win. Now he's getting tired. His hands are getting heavy from the transgressions of the mitzvos, as the Jews are weak in mitzvos, it weakens his hands. Just like he can represent their kavanot, they represent him. Our sages say, in the days of Hillel, there were many elders who could have prophecy like Moshe Rabbeinu, and they did not, because the people of Israel weren't worthy. So there's a relationship here. When the people are one way, it affects the leader. The leader affects the people, and the people affect the leader. They're intimately connected. So they prepare for Moshe two rocks to support his hand. And from here we see that when the Jewish people are suffering, everyone should partake. Moshe's on the hilltop. Couldn't they prepare him something more gentle than two rocks? They want to support his hand. So bring him two cushions. Bring him two pillows. No. If everyone's suffering, he's with them. And Aaron and Hur come up with him. Remember this. Aaron and Hur are with him. Hur is Aaron's brother-in-law, is Aaron's nephew. So we have to remember this because we're going to see that Hur is going to be left in charge together with Aaron when Moshe ascends to Mount Sinai. So we encounter him here for the first time. Yes? Hur is the son of Miriam. So he's Aaron and Moshe's nephew. Big tzaddik. When the Jews will want to do the golden calf, Hur is going to stand up to them and they'll murder him. So Yehoshua leads us to war. Yehoshua is from which tribe? Yehoshua is from the tribe of Yosef. Yehoshua is from Ephraim, from the tribe of Yosef.
And we have a tradition that Yosef is the one that takes down Amalek. That's why Yoshua leads the war against Amalek and he is successful. And we remember this, that
Yosef take out Amalek if Yosef's dead.
The tribe of Yosef. Oh, when Yosef was born, that's when Yaakov had the courage to go and face Esav again. Because Yosef represents the fire that can destroy Amalek. So, Shem promises us he will ultimately wipe out Amalek. And the Torah concludes our parsha with, Ki yad al keis ya milchama l'Hashem ba'amalek midodo. What does it mean, ki yad al keis ka? The hand on the throne of Hashem. So Rashi quotes a pshat everyone knows, that it's as though Hashem puts his hand on his throne and says, I promise, I have a constant fight with Amalek. Every generation has their Amalek. And Hashem says, I'm leading the fight against them. But the Rosh says an important pshat here. The Rosh says the throne of Hashem is what? Is Jerusalem. Kiyad, when there will be a representation, when there will be a king on the throne of Hashem. The throne of Hashem is Jerusalem. Jerusalem represents the throne of Hashem. Says the Rosh, and that is why for generations the people of the world are trying to take Jerusalem away from us. Jerusalem represents the antithetical force to Amalek. Amalek is the cruelty of the world. Amalek is the hatred of the world. What fights the hatred of the world? Yerushalayim, Jerusalem. Ein tov ela Yerushalayim. You want to know what good? Goodness is represented by Jerusalem. Ein ahava ela Yerushalayim. You want to know what love is? Jerusalem represents love. You want to know where heaven and earth meet? Jerusalem is the meeting ground. Jerusalem is where you have the temple where people focus their prayers and blessings from heaven come down below. Prophecy comes from Jerusalem. So Jerusalem represents the great connector, the connector between man and his creator, the connector between all of humanity. Everyone used to have representation in Jerusalem in King Solomon's time. Every nation would send representatives there. That's why Koheles was written for the nations. The nations would come up to Jerusalem and they'd hear the words of philosophy and they'd come back and teach their people and they would promote monotheism. Shlomo HaMelech writes Koheles because every nation has representation at the temple. Amalek is the opposite. Amalek represents constant battle, constant hatred, enmity. What's Amalek today? We'll say that offline. Those of you who want to know what Amalek is, come to Machon Meir. The Gemara in Talmud Rosh Hashanah and in Tractate Megillah tells us, but you have to learn the two together to know what the Gemara is really telling you. And you have to learn the commentary of the Gra. So Amalek is the one that constantly fights. They're the antithetical force. But the world, the enemies of Israel are always fighting that we should not have Jerusalem, says the Rosh. And that's why the ultimate fight is about Jerusalem. Ki yad al keis ka. Hashem says once there's representation on that throne, then the fight comes out against Amalek. And our sages had a tradition that it works both ways. You have to fight Amalek in order to establish Jerusalem. And when Jerusalem is established, you could finish the fight with Amalek. And that's why the Prima Godim writes, that's why we set up a day of celebration on Purim. Because our sages said, if we fought Amalek, if on Purim we were victorious against Amalek, ki yad al keis ka, then it must be that the next step is the rebuilding of the temple. Our sages saw in Purim the foundation for the rebuilding of the second temple. So they said, we celebrate Purim because you have to have Vila Malshini Maltehi Tikva Vechol Arisha Kerega Toved. Just as in Shmona Esrei we say, let those sinners, let those wicked ones be demolished. From there we go to Allah Tzadikim to Vili Yerushalayim Ircha. That's the evolvement of the world. You have to eradicate evil. You have to fight the evil in order to establish that which is just and correct and good and kind and loving. And that's the promise we have at the end of the parasha, that Hashem will keep the fight up. And notice that Yoshua does not win the fight. He is victorious in the battle, but the fight is not over. The fight continues for generations.